So, let me start with there are two general points about. First of all, there are three points I want to make. First of all, evolution is, in my view, the most sophisticated and difficult area of what I will generally call regulation molecular biology. Not only does it include all of the complexities of understanding the genomic control of development, but it also includes the problem of understanding how that control system changes with time. So it involves, plus it also involves understanding how animals are related to one another. And it involves, in addition, understanding something about the real-time geological record, or paleontological record, of what really happened in evolution. And I'm talking now about animal evolution. I'm not talking about bacterial or prokaryote evolution. So this means integrating a really large amount of diverse information, and that's the first point. So people often say, when I was a kid and I went to college, and I had a professor who was probably educated about 1910 or so, and he used to say, if you can't explain what you're looking at in biology in terms of evolution, you don't understand it. Well, he of course didn't understand any of it, but he was exactly right. And so this is a deep, difficult, and fascinating challenge. But it's like development, it's become accessible with our understanding of, in my view, of genomics and genomic regulatory systems. Say what? Who that said that? He was a obscure teacher of biology one in University of Pennsylvania in 1954 called Schmieder. I don't remember his first name. And he died of a brain tumor a couple of years after I had that course with him. And we had a textbook that was, I think it was about 1920 or so. And like everything, it had it did something that we are going to return to in the next few minutes in this talk, which is begin by discussing different groups of animals and how they were related, except that everything it said about how they were related was erroneous, because that whole subject has totally been revolutionized within the last 15 years. Anyway, so the second general point I want to make is that the pathway to understanding animal evolution is by the simple syllogism as follows, that, and I'm talking now about changes in body plans, the sort of thing you can see in a fossil record, the sort of thing that means, or the sort of thing that results in the differences in body plans of the animals that we see on Earth today. So simple syllogism is that the body plan is the outcome of a developmental process. The developmental process is controlled at the regulatory level by the kind of genomic regulatory apparatus that I was discussing with you last week. And since evolution is a change in the body plan, it means change in that regulatory program. So the answer to the problem of body plan evolution is understanding how gene regulatory programs change for development. Regulatory programs for development change. The third general thing is that you can't think straight about any part of evolution which we carry out today by comparing regulatory systems or other characteristics of living animals unless you know how those animals are related to one another. And so, for example, it makes very little sense to consider that, as people did very vociferously as recently as some famous people whose names you know, as recently as the 1980s, that Drosophila and us are both segmented animals, and so we had a segmented ancestor. and of which we're the common ancestor, and that comes from a completely faulty understanding of phylogeny. If you think that way, you think one thing about the processes you're looking. If you realize it's not true, then you think another way about the process of segmentation. So that's just an example. But it's an example, the import of which is that the starting place is to know how animals really relate to one another. And when I was in college and long thereafter, the main argument was that animals fell into. Now I'm talking about the bilaterium animals, which is to say those which have an anterior, posterior, a through gut, a head, and a tail, and mesodermal layers in their body, which excludes cnidarians, which are jellyfish, hydra, and sea anemones, and some other smaller groups that you may know about. But so the bilateria were traditionally to me in my life, thought to have been divided into two large groups, protostomes and deuterostomes, based on a very insightful, and I wasn't going to talk about this except because I assumed that someone had talked to you about it, but I'm going to take 15 minutes and discuss this. I'm going to tell you. Okay. And based on an insightful examination of embryos done in 1909 by a German anatomist called Groben, who decided that the animals fell into two groups. Those embryos in which the initial invagination of the embryo, the primary invagination, which forms the gut, that the site of that invagination becomes the anus in one group and it becomes the mouth in the other group. And so he conveniently divided the animal world into these two groups. And it turns out that he had to do something a little bit more because not all animals can even make the call. Some invaginate at both ends and this and that. But you could always find a close, an obvious relative of one that did it simply one way or the other. And so he, based on embryological anatomical affinities, he and others argued that, strangely enough, the echinoderms and the chordates, which is us, are related to each other, as we're both deuterostomes, and hemichordates, which are a group of invertebrate, rather fancy invertebrate worms that we need to think about much further today, are the other major group of the deuterostomes. There's been one other phylum that was discovered last year or 2 years ago on a deep water site in a rotting vessel 6,000 feet off Stockholm Bay. That's now the fourth group of deuterostomes. Rather, it was a parasite in a clam that was living there. But these are basically the deuterostomes. And fast forward to the present time, this turns out to be the most, based on molecular criteria, the most robust of all phylogenetic superclades, the deuterostomes. So you can take the deuterostomes to the bank. So
are all the other ones really protostomes?
No, I'm going to get to that. So when I was growing up, the protostomes were divided into several groups, and the biggest group was the one that included arthropods and annelids, because they're both segmented. You know, earthworms are annelids, arthropods are insects and lobsters, and they're obviously segmented. But it turns out that was very incorrect. And not until people began to use molecular phylogeny and very fancy computational algorithms to do a tedious and difficult job of analyzing the results of molecular phylogeny was animal phylogeny straightened out. And there's still areas of it which remain contentious. But as of the mid-90s, which is fairly recently, the following has happened. Another very robust group like the deuterostomes, I should say what this method is. It consists of taking molecules that are shared by all organisms. And the first one that was used successfully extensively is ribosomal RNA. So everybody has ribosomal RNA. And ribosomal RNA is a number of residues which are free to change and others that change at somewhat slower rates. Free to change means relative to some that can't change at all. And it turns out that you and your evolutionary cousin have much less change than your first cousin, than you and your second cousin, or you and your fourth cousin, and your tenth cousin. And so the farther, the more distant the relationship, the greater the difference in the ribosomal RNA sequence, which nonetheless is similar enough so it can be aligned, so you can actually compute the number of steps it would take to get from a sequence that you're looking at in one animal to a sequence you're looking at in the other animal. And so elegant algorithms were written to enable vast data sets that consisted of 50 or 100 different ribosomal RNA sequences to be organized in nested sets of minimal change pathways. And on that basis, new phylogenies were made, and then they were combined with some obvious anatomical characteristics. For example, some animals, like all arthropods, for example, have ventral nerve cords. And all deuterostomes, if they have the chordates, have dorsal nerve cords. So, and there are other characteristics which one can point to that are large anatomical characteristics, and a confusing welter of additional anatomical characteristics, some of which were trivial and others of which are important, but they were confused. And so anatomically based phylogeny, even the 90s, where people used computers and made great big tables of traits and characters that were shared or not shared, and used computational methods to see who was related to who, gave the wrong answer often because of the mixture of trivial and important traits. And if a trait is trivial, if it can easily change, then it can screw you up by its distribution. So molecular phylogeny did the following. It produced a large group of animals, which is shown in blue here, that are now called ecdysozoans. Now, in the traditional, Groben's traditional idea, which was that all of these animals that aren't deuterostomes and aren't cnidarians are protostomes. Some of them, it is true that the initial blastoporal invagination becomes the mouth. Some of them you can't make that call. But anyway, we now have another very robust group called the ecdysozoans. And curiously enough, it's an important point, two of the main model systems for genetics, which are nematodes and Drosophila, are both ecdysozoans. So they do not represent, another thing that was wrong that was claimed was that nematodes represent a basal form of Bilaterian, something that represents a simple ancestral type. That's not true. So all arthropods and all nematodes are equally related to the basal form, as this little cladogram shows. So the common ancestor of ecdysozoans is here. Here are arthropods, here are nematodes. And there are all kinds of other things that we don't have to worry about at the moment that are also current, living ecdysozoans. That left a large number of other invertebrates, the most prominent of which are annelids and mollusks. But one thing that you can see right away is that the arthropods are not more closely related to the annelids than either is to other creatures. That's untrue. And so the way to think about this logically is that all ecdysozoans are more closely related to one another than any is to any other group. They have a common ancestor. And that matters to everything you want to do. For example, you want to compare genes, then that means you need to be able to compare it in animals that have a common ancestor, so you can think that the genes you're looking at have a common ancestor. A gene that's in an arthropod and a gene that's in a chordate has a common ancestor, all right, but it's way back at the root of all the bilaterian. And so this other group were named Lophotrochozoans, and it's probably a forgettable name because that group's going to fall apart. And it's probably going to fall apart into at least two other groups, and at least two and maybe three groups. And the three main groups are this clade down here, which this phylogeny correctly shows related to one another. And they all make swimming ciliated larvae, which have a certain kind of form. And some are segmented, like the annelids, but some are not, like the mollusks, or the nemerteans, or the sipunculans. And so it's almost certain that their common ancestor was not segmented. And therefore, it's impossible that the common ancestor of the arthropods and these guys was segmented. And in fact, many of these ichthyosaurs are also not segmented. So segmentation is something that was not inherited from a common ancestor. It arose independently several times. And as we've learned about annelid, the molecular biology of annelid segmentation is totally different from that of arthropod segmentation, as this phylogeny would have predicted, but which the earlier phylogeny predicted the opposite. There are another group of very little known Lophotrochozoans, which have tentacles on their heads. They live mostly in deep sea water, and they're called lophophorates. And they are probably more closely related to the annelid group than they are to the ichthyosaurs, but it's not clear that that's true. And then there are some, the only living invertebrate animals that really are likely to be representatives of basal early evolving forms are the acele flatworms, which is a group of flatworms, which are these guys. And this is erroneous because it should have one group of these flatworms should be broken out and a branch come right out at the, probably at the base of the bilateria or the base of this protostome assemblage of bilateria, which are acele flatworms. And one of the dark almost totally concealed aspects of biology are the characteristics of this whole group. Only a couple of these genomes have even been sequenced. No one has ever done a molecular biology experiment on any of their embryos to speak of. We know nothing about them, yet they're a major group of animals in the world, and they're very interesting. Their genomes are interesting. Everything's interesting about them, but we just don't know anything about them. None of our model systems, quote-unquote, are in this Lophotrochozoan group. Some people are now beginning to work on these acele flatworms, but not at a molecular level, really. So the main model systems are nematodes, arthropods, Drosophila, and some other insects, and a few crustacea. Chordates, which of course we know the most about, echinoderms, which you were hearing about the other day from me, and those are the model systems, and most of them are chordates. Ascidians are chordates, frogs are chordates, mice are chordates, fish are chordates, humans are chordates. So our knowledge in terms of the animal, the bilaterian world, is not at all equally distributed, and it's mainly we actually know more about chordates and echinoderms and more about arthropods than we know about all the rest times 100. So then the take home, and then I should add one thing, that while the deuterostome part of Groben's 1909 idea is you can take to the bank, the protostome part has only weak support, and it's not at all clear that the ichthyosaurs and these guys, weak molecular support, and these guys are more closely related to one another than either is to the Deuterostomes, that could fall apart. And there's a weak phylogenetic signal in every molecular phylogeny study of that subject. Yeah. Sionis accordae. I can't hear quite what you're saying, I'm sorry. But... Using proteins? Yeah. So nowadays, there's been an additional, much fancier set of methods of using large sets of 50 to 200 proteins that are shared amongst all these animals. For example, everybody has histones. Everybody has a large group of metabolic basal metabolism enzymes. And many of those proteins are very conserved. And so it's been possible to align them as well. It's harder. More complicated algorithms are needed. But in general, the protein phylogenies have basically completely confirmed it, this phylogeny that I'm showing you. There have been no major differences. There have been some arguments within the chordates that have given controversial results about which chordates most closely relate to which of the invertebrate chordates, which are probably half right and half wrong, and that you may have seen in the journal recently. And molecular phylogeny of proteins has another possible use, which is to at least attempt to get a time dimension for these divergence points. So what this is basically a logical construct of similarity of shared molecules, which shows on the basis of logic, essentially, of character distribution, both anatomical and good anatomical characters and molecular differences, who's most closely related to who, where the common ancestors are. So, for example, this is one clade. This is the outgroup of that clade. And this is the common ancestor of all Ecdysozoans. So it tells us which are the common ancestors. But this is not, there's no timeline on this. This does not, cannot be directly related by any internal evidence from the molecular phylogeny as to whether this time branch is running on the same scale as this time branch. Now, there are ways of getting at that, which I'm going to get to in a minute, but this is a logic diagram, not a time diagram. It's a relationship diagram.
But a molecular ribosome.
Say what?
The molecular,
yeah.
Ribosome.
This one I'm showing you is ribosome, but the protein ones agree with it entirely. You can get a clock from the ribosome ones. You can't get a clock from because the changes saturate too soon, and you can't calibrate them. Protein ones you can. And so, I just want to give you this introduction because I'm going to assume, given kinds of phylogenetic relationship in the talk I was going to give you today. So I wanted to do this first because I thought somebody would have talked to you about this. So, huh? That's exactly what this diagram is about. Okay, so now here is a complicated diagram that has a lot of information, and I know I'm here to talk about the evolutionary process of regulatory genomic evolution, which is what I'm really interested in, but I like to talk about real things, and I like you to think about real things, and so I'm going to start this off by giving you a real-time, a very, very, very quick superficial scan of real-time geology, paleontology, and animal diversification as according to the fossil record. The fossil record in paleontology is the truth serum of evolution, because it tells you what really happened when and what's really there. And it has many, many blind things you can't see in the paleontological record, and it tells you nothing whatsoever about process, It tells you nothing about cladistics. It tells you nothing about relationship. But it does give you real-time calibration points. And that's incredibly valuable. So here is that same first place to start is where we just left out. Here's that same phylogeny, basically, in a simplified form. These are the deuterostomes. These are the Lophotrochozoans. And these are the Ecdysozoans, right? So only a few representative groups are shown in each one. These are flatworms. These are mollusks. These are annelids, earthworms. These are the hemichordates. These are echinoderms. I could have put chordates in here, which is the most important group, but didn't. I didn't actually make this diagram. It was made by someone else. These are flies, and these are some invertebrate worms that look like what their name sounds, preapulids. I'll show you a fossil one in a minute. But, and these are the outgroups, which are cnidarians. These are sea anemones, and these are jellyfish, and these are sponges. So these are the bilateria. And what you see here, and I am not responsible for the idiocy of putting three significant figures on these on this chart, which is an intellectual crime I would never let my graduate student do. But anyway,
how many
Maybe two, but maybe you can bring it to two or two with an error. what those dates are the dates in millions of years that protein phylogeny gives you for the divergence points that we know according to the logic of cladistics existed. And the way that's done is to take proteins, for example, from a frog and a rat, and we know that the last common ancestor of a frog and a rat was an early tetrapod that emerged onto land, and we have a good fossil record of the emergence at the beginning of the tetrapods, which is somewhere 330, 350 million years ago. So we can say this much difference in histone C occurs, and I'm going to call that a calibration point for 350 million years. I'll do the same thing for enol phosphatase and enol 1 phosphohydrolase, and the same thing for this and the same thing for that. I'm going to get a calibration point in 350 million years. Then I can go a little further. I know that the starfish and sea urchins evolved from the first free-living echinoderm right at the end of the Cambrian, and we know that that was about 500 million years ago. So now I can get another calibration point for those same proteins in there. So now I have some calibration points that take me back to the Cambrian period when fossils of most current animal phyla appeared. And so at least if I now have to extrapolate back to divergences which occur before there was a fossil record, like all of these divergence points, at least I'm not in the position of having calibration points down here at my ordinate intercept and extrapolating out to here, which is a good way not to, good thing not to do. So the calibration points extend at least two-thirds of the way back to the point that you're interested in. So you can take that with whatever grain of salt you like. It's possible. But the argument is, and people were careful to use sets of proteins that gave the same intersect, the same common ancestry point, despite the fact that those proteins are themselves moving at somewhat different rates. But using the calibration points, they give more or less the same number. So there have been three detailed studies done with large protein sets in the last few years. And they disagree in detail, naturally. But they all agree on one thing, which is that so this is the beginning of the Cambrian at 543 million years, which has now been dated plus or minus 1 million years with extremely good accuracy using uranium lead radioisotope decay and very sensitive mass spectroscopy. Say what? It's geological. It's a rock formation in Wales. So it turns out that any time there's volcanic activity, volcanic ash deposits fall all over the world. If it's a big, and these things have happened continuously all the time, and so it's those little, and they're little glass particles in them called zircons that contain the uranium residues that are required to get these very accurate dates. If you can find the zircons, you can get a very accurate date. And it's been a revolution that mainly it's been due to a guy called Sam Baring at MIT. and Grotzinger also. So all of the calibrated protein phylogenies agree that the divergence points for the common ancestor of the Lophotrochozoan, such as they are, or the group of animals that are going to be that, of the deuterostomes, of the Ecdysozoans, and of the Bilateria in general, fall within maybe 100 million years before the beginning of the Cambrian, which is very interesting in view of something else, which is the realization in planetary science, which is again only from the late 90s. So this is an area that's been changing rapidly. that until about 630 million years, and this date is wrong, it should be 630, it should be back here, the Earth was almost entirely covered with glaciers and ice. And so there was a vast worldwide glaciation, actually several incidents of it that began about 720 or so and extended until 630 when it ended. Now, there were refugia, places that weren't frozen, but the consequences are very easy to see, and as soon as people opened their eyes and started to look what was there in the geological record, because there was immense deposits of calcium carbonate related minerals just feet and feet and feet, meters thick at the follow the end of this due to changes in ocean chemistry that resulted from glaciers melting. But the sea was very anoxic after that for a while, and the oxygen levels rose rather sharply towards the end of this period. So I think one of the things I cannot prove, but I think that one of the things that may be true about Precambrian life is that the animals that we have on Earth today, their ancestors diverged from one another, and the Bilaterian ancestor diverged from the jellyfish and Hydra ancestor after Snowball Earth ended. And so probably the period between 630 and the beginning of the Cambrian is an extremely interesting one. And I'm going to show you, unfortunately, it's almost enigmatic from a fossil point of view. There's very little fossil evidence from that period, but I will show you something. So the yellow and blue parts of this diagram are taken from some very well-trodden analyses that were done in the 80s by Sepkowski and a number of other people. And what they did was count the number of different groups that were found in the Cambrian fossil record. So the Cambrian begins here, and this is the early and later Cambrian ends about here. And so this is what's called the Cambrian explosion that you've always heard of. So in terms of the number of classes of animals or the number of orders, there's a huge increase that happened rather abruptly as far as the fossil record tells us. So, of course...
Is it true that there are four purple boxes at the bottom? Is it true that the places actually
they're the sites where most information has come from. There are many sites. You can see Cambrian fossils in Utah if you want to look at low-quality ones, but they're very common. You can see them in Northern California. You can see them. You can see them in Wales. You can see them all over the world. But most of the beautiful fossils, such as you can see in 1 minute, come from two places: the Burgess Shale, which was explored around 1910 in northwest Canada, and then very recently, in the end of the 80s and into the 90s, and up to including the present, there's a place in Yunnan Province in China called Shenzhen. Were spectacular, another spectacular assemblage of Cambrian fossils has occurred. But there are also beautiful Cambrian fossils in Iceland. They're all over the world. Greenland, I'm sorry. I meant to say Greenland. Thank you. They're all over the world. And except in places that are all volcanic, right? And the Shenzhen site, where I've been, you can just walk along, and it's a mudstone, and there are little sort of flaky, flat little pieces of stone. And if you just look, if you have sharp eyes, or if you don't have sharp eyes, crawl and look, you will see within a few meters something interesting in that stuff. And the same is true, allegedly, in Burgess Shale, although it's an inaccessible place. It's very high up in a nasty, treeless, rocky place, unless you like that kind of terrain. So, now by orders and classes, for those of you who aren't familiar with Linnaean classification, the animal groups, all these groups are what are called phyla. So a phylum is a group of animals that has definitive shared body plan characteristics. For example, the definitive characteristics and that no other animals have. But the definitive characteristics of the chordates are a dorsal nerve cord. That's one definitive characteristic. Also, branchial arches and gill slits, which is a second definitive characteristic, and also a notochord, which is a cartilaginous structure which is found in embryonic forms of vertebrates, but in invertebrate chordates is can be an adult structure, and in fossil chordates. So those are definitive characteristics of chordates. Definitive characteristics of echinoderms, for example, are a radial adult body plan, a water vascular system. No other animals have those characteristics. So each of these groups has a set of definitive body plan characteristics. Every one of them. But, of course, there are many varieties of chordates, there are many varieties of echinoderms, there are many varieties of arthropods. And so those varieties were classified by Linnaeus in the early 19th century according to, in a hierarchical manner. So the highest grade taxon below phylum is class. So, for example, there are five echinoderm classes. There's starfish, there's sea urchins, there's sea cucumbers, there's brittle stars, and there's crinoids. And there are a number of chordate classes. There's the vertebrates is one class, the ascidians or tunicates like Cyona is another class, the cephalochordates is another class. So a class is a big, a large umbrella, but it, again, for the class, there are a set of characters shared only by that class and not shared by other classes, but all of them have the phyletic characters. And going down, so this is classes of all phyla, and going down, the next step is orders. So, for example, in the vertebrates, mammals are in order. and then there are families, and then there are genera, and then there are species. So there's a hierarchical set of taxons which everyone has used, and I'm going to show you if I get there at the end of this lecture that I think there's an underlying mechanistic argument that supports Linnaean taxonomy. Huh? Well, we know from looking, you know, for example, that all mammals have something similar to one another, right? We all have fur of some kind, for instance, and no other. So we might say therefore there must be a common ancestor of all mammals that had the characteristics shared by all mammals. So it's an important designation if you want to think about our evolution, right? That means that there is some point in evolution where a mammalian ancestor appeared that was different from a frog ancestor or a bird ancestor. We also know that, and the birds are another class, they have things that we don't have. So that makes perfect sense, right? Okay, well let's take each part of it. So species are defined empirically a number of ways, but basically in terms of whether these animals can breed with each other and make a fertile offspring. And that problem is that definition has a number of problems with it, but unless you want to discuss them, we'll use definitions. So that's the bottom line. So but yet we also know that, for instance, we know that lions and house cats and cheetahs and tigers they're all species, but they can't breed with each other. We know they're all cats. So we say that there's a level of hierarchy which relates all the species that are very similar, like in this case, and we call that a genus. Now, between genus and family, you could rightly ask the question, what kind of real sense is there? What's the absolute criteria? And indeed, it is clearly the case that in different groups of animals, like insects versus cats, the amount of difference it takes to be called a different genus as opposed to a different family is just arbitrary. So, but nonetheless, there's maybe a sliding scale of hierarchy, whatever you like, because one thing we do know from the fossil record is that species live only maybe 10 or 15 million years or less. A few million years. Genera, 15 to 30 million years. Families, much longer. And orders, much longer. So I think that the class and order designations represent body plan distinctions that are very large and are easily supportable. Between family and genus, you can say what you like, and sometimes between species. In some places, things would be called different genera than other places on the animal phylogenetic tree would be called different species. So the lower levels, it's a continuum. The upper levels, there's no question that there are these discontinuous sets of characters. The problem with the species argument is the famous one of the circumpolar gulls. You're going to get me talking the whole time about natural history. I want to get on to other things, but anyway, where in each little region, the gulls can breed with the gulls from next door, and so forth, as you go around the Arctic Circle. But if you take gulls from the opposite side, they can't breed with each other. So where do you draw the line between the different species? And, huh? That's called a ring species, yeah. And it's not really a species by the usual criteria, but on the other hand, they certainly aren't different genera either. So anyway, there are lots of problems with the definition of species. Sometimes the animals are very much alike, like red and white abalones, and the only difference between them is that the sperm is that there's a protein that isn't recognized by the sperm on the egg, so they can't fertilize each other. So there's a range of differences. On the other hand, anyway, so the the two things I'm showing you here then is that there is a dramatic appearance in the fossil record of different, of diversity at the class and order level. So I claim that class and orders are reasonable arguments. And that, I mean, there is really a difference between a starfish and a sea urchin. There's no question about that. And there's a, so if you just want to think about classes for that minute, there are a lot more different kinds of animals appear here than there were not long before on the geological scale. That's the Cambrian explosion. And the second thing is that molecular protein phylogeny suggests that the divergences occurred in the previous 100 million years. Now, of course, you can always ask, is this, as it's often said, is this an explosion of fossils, explosion of animals, or an explosion of fossils? And one of the things that happened at the Cambrian was that that the population of animals are dense and predation is apparently a way of life of many of the animals, and so lots of things have shells, carapaces, and other kinds of easily fossilizable body protections. So you might say, well, this is ridiculous. This is when things that are robust enough to fossilize appeared, not when they appeared. And there's a definitely a serious question that paleontologists call a taphonomic question as to whether you're looking at a change in organisms or a change in fossilizability here. If we look at Cambrian fossils, though, there's something that's quite remarkable to be seen. And I think what I'm going to tell you next is one of the most important things to know about animal evolution. So this is a Burgess shale fossil. This is not a simple little featureless worm. It's a highly evolved, extremely elaborate creature, which you can instantly recognize as some kind of a crustacean or arthropod from today's animals. And so many of the classes that are seen here in all kinds of groups of animals, including single cell diatoms and all kind, everything you look at, are very elegant things like that, and they cannot have sprung forth fully blooms from so it's fully blown, so to speak. They're complicated things. Here's a preapulid, as I mentioned before. This is a fossil preapulid. It looks, it's a beautifully conserved fossil, as you can see. So you don't have to guess about what these structures were. These are very, very, very well preserved things. This is Burgess shale. This is Chengjiang. And yeah. These are all marine. Everything whatsoever was marine. And they're all, most of a shallow benthic environment. You know from the geology that it's marine, unequivocally marine. No large animal life appears on land until around 400 million AD and most of it after that. Right, so for AD, 400 million years ago. Well, that's a very interesting question, but there was a lot of evolutionary change in both arthropods and vertebrates that enabled, those are the two main groups that went onto land, arthropod insects and descendants of fish. And that fossil transition is very well documented. So this is just a reconstruction. So these are things you can, they're different than what lives today, but we can immediately recognize, we know what that is, that's an antenna, we know that. These are just like the swimming legs of many shrimp of today. This is a drawing of a fossil of which there are about 250 copies known. Some of these things are only known in a few copies, but, and it's about 2 centimeters long, and it's a primitive, it's a cephalochordate. It's just of the grade of organization of Amphioxus, which many of you have heard of. It's a chord, it's definitely a chordate. Here's its notochord. It has gill slits. Its brain was up here. It has, these are its somites. It has many characteristics that are familiar to us. Here's just an assemblage of lots of these different kinds of things. And I don't want to spend time talking about fossils. This is an ascidian like Siona. And the top ones, these are Burgess Shale and these are Shane John. And the real thing I want to tell you, is that contrary to the rather lurid imagination of Steve Gould and others in the 80s, who wrote books on these things in which he said there were all kinds of forms that have since disappeared from Earth, it's not true. And what is true is that probably every phylum we have on Earth today was represented the Cambrian, and probably there are no Cambrian organisms that don't fit into those phyla. So at the phylum level, the general true statement is that all of the animal phyla today were present in the Cambrian. And we haven't lost any phyla since this far. And there may be one exception of some kinds of sea spiders that people claim are a phylum level designation and which appeared in the Ordovician after the end of the Cambrian.
Yeah, so I'm sort of wondering how you validate such a statement.
Well, because on an anatomical basis, so the character, if you write down the characters of this thing, well, you can easily see what this is. This is a preapulid. It has this segmentation and this proboscis, and sort of exactly like modern preapulids. Well, only these guys are both segmented and have this proboscis, as a matter of fact. But this also happens to have just the same proportions as modern preapulids. It has this collar also, which they have, and this has that branchial basket and the tentacular structure and so forth and so forth. The arthropods you define by having jointed appendages, which these things clearly had, and segments. There are great differences in the, for instance, most arthropods that you see from the Cambrian, many of them were a group called the Lobopodia, which are represented today by only a very obscure, few very obscure species, particularly the velvet worm in Australia, but at the Cambrian, there were many arthropods, including many arthropods. They were like this thing. They had appendages, but no joint. No, they didn't have jointed appendages like the arthropods do. Otherwise, their body plan is similar. They had one less head segment and so forth. So people, needless to say, have spun their wheels extensively looking at the anatomy of these things. And I can't go into the details of that. I just want to make a statement that I think is of large scientific importance in thinking about evolution, which was the phyletic diversity of the Bilateria was present at the Cambrian. And so and not a lot more than that. That is correct. So that means that the phylum level body plans were canalized somehow. So that also that those animals occupied the environmental niches that were available. Unfortunately, I don't know when you were talking about, but a lot of that was due to misinterpretation of fossils. For example, if you turn something that has spines on its back and jointless legs on its bottom, if you turn it upside down, you get a very unusual looking creature, all right, that definitely doesn't look like anything that lives today. And that was exactly what happened with one major case like that. Or confuse its head with its other end and so forth. And then you can really think you're looking at a most unusual form of organism. And so I might say it's hard to interpret some of these fossils. I've seen a lot of fossils, and you really, it's hard to get their characteristics until you have multiple specimens of them. So we're looking then, in considering body plan divergence, we're looking in this dark period at events that we can infer happen because the result is apparent here. And those events were the origin of the phylum level body plans that are on Earth today. There is absolutely nothing in the way of any multicellular animal fossil, possible exception of things like Volvox, which is basically a colonial protozoan, prior to Snowball Earth. If you go back to 720 and deeper, there is nothing whatsoever that can be found in the fossil record that looks like any kind of animal organism. Nothing whatsoever. Now, just before the Cambrian, there appear large, the earliest group of large fossils, which are called the Ediacaran fauna sometimes. And they're also an enigmatic group. They do not resemble and are not ancestral to any Bilaterian, that's for sure. Many of them seem to have been flat organisms or organisms that were made of thin tissue that may have folded, and some of them are quite large, like a meter across, and they form whorls or pens. They could have been some form of sponge. My guess is that they belong to that lineage or cnidarian, but they certainly were not bilaterian. But they indicate that something had changed so that something large that was animal-like could exist. And one thing that changed as the geological record shows is a sharp rise in oxygen. So right after the end of Snowball Earth, the sea was anoxic, about to the level of the depths of the Black Sea, which is very, very anoxic today. And that was due probably to photosynthetic organisms and a number of other complicated geochemical things. If you go back a little further in time, the most interesting stuff to see is the stuff from southwest China called Duxiantou, where there was a unique form of preservation that has yielded some microfossils you can only see under the microscope. So like so much else, this field's been revolutionized in the last few years because of new technology or application of different technology. And so people began making thin rock sections. Well, petrologists have done this to look at oil-bearing strata for half a century at least. But they began looking, and in these rock sections under a good transmission microscope, you can see amazing things like these. Now, anybody would say that's an embryo. It's an obvious embryo. It's a multicellular embryo. And you can see them in scanning EM. You can digest them out of the rock. And now these things are being studied with high-energy synchrotron-driven X-ray tomography. Which I'm not going to, that's another story, I'm not going to show you that story, but it's clear that there are a variety of kinds of embryos. But seeing embryos is sort of like, this is now way earlier, this is about 30 million years, the real date is about 590 to 600, that's 30 million years after the end of Snowball Earth. But seeing embryos is sort of like those Robinson Crusoe stories of seeing footprints leading out of the jungle. You know there's something in there because you can see the footprints, but you don't know what it was that made the footprints or made the embryos.
Is it possible that embryos are forked that don't develop?
Well, they'd have to eat, or it's hard to imagine. And they look, and some of them, which I'm not showing you here, have characteristics that are very similar to modern embryos. They have macromeres and micromeres. They have symmetrical arrangements of rows of cells. And I don't want to take our time away, but it's a fascinating story. I think that there's going to be a revolution in understanding of what was there. The only thing that looks like a complex organism that's been found is this little guy, which is called Vernanimalcula. There's nothing known adult. That's what I'm telling you. It's like seeing footsteps leading out of the jungle, and you know that something made the footsteps. These are the embryos of something, but we don't know what it was. Well, the embryos are found. It's possible that the embryos were washed away from the place where the adults were lived and preserved by wave action or something, and preserved in a place where the adults didn't go. Well, because something has to make an embryo. Well, that's what he asked, but it's got to feed itself somehow. It's got to make cells somehow. So there is this thing that was found. Maybe they weren't embryos, weren't adults, but maybe they were too, is all I'm saying. So here's something interesting that was found. Now, not in the same place as the embryos, but in a nearby place, which is a different kind of a section. Yeah, this was a very organic, rich kind of shale, which has lots of stuff in it, different interesting things. And this guy is pretty interesting. It's, again, a section, a slide section, and you're looking through with transmitted light, and this thing looks like a coelomate animal with two coeloms, one on either side, a digestive tract, a mouth. It looks like a little biotarian, possibly. And it's only a few hundred microns long, but at least it's got what seem to be many cells. And you could say you don't know what it is, and maybe you don't know what it is, but maybe it's something interesting. And something was here because something was certainly here because we saw the elegant outcome of it here. So I just want to leave you with that as far as a sort of real-time sketch of animal evolution, which you may or may not find informative, but I think it's important to have in mind just what the dimensions of the problem are. Okay, so now I want to get to the question of looking at evolution from a gene regulatory point of view. So the major process is what's been called co-option, which is a process in which regulatory genes, which were functioning somewhere in the organism at some time in development, acquire new functions. That means getting a new regulatory systems of some kind. And examples of this are legion and important. And I could obviously talk all day just about this, but here's one example. You're looking here at the expression of a gene called brachyury. Brachyury was isolated as a mouse mutant, in which the mutant form, one mutant form, has a crooked tail, and severe mutant forms fail to form a notochord. And it turns out that brachyury is an essential gene for notochord formation in the chordates. And if you look at a chordate where brachyury is expressed, it's expressed in the notochord, not surprisingly. But if you look at other organisms, it's expressed in quite different places. It's expressed in insects in the hindgut. It's expressed in hemichordates, in the coeloms, all three of its coeloms. It's expressed in sea urchins around the blastopore and the hindgut. It's expressed in cnidarians at the opening of the body cavity, which serves as both mouth and anus in those animals. Since we know the phylogeny and the clade and the cladistics, we can back calculate what the sequence of expression domains was. So its initial expression was probably expression in the posterior gut because all of these animals or their relatives had that quality. Then, except for the ecdysozoans, it's expressed in the posterior mesoderm in all these other animals. And of course, all these other animals only use deuterostomes because we don't know anything about the local trochozoans. So in this case, the insects have the original, retain the original primitive bilaterian expression. But in the deuterostomes, there are many other forms of expression appeared as these little ticks appear. So that's a typical, it's not an atypical, it's a typical example of something that happens in evolution, which is using regulatory genes in different times and places. Well, regulatory genes are regulatory genes. They regulate other genes. And so you can see immediately that they will have pleiotropic hierarchical effects. Certainly that happens too, as exemplified right here. So in the echinoderms, the primitive expression in the posterior gut and posterior mesoderm disappear. That happens, of course, as well. Okay. One of the great examples, of course, is the famous exemplar of what's supposed to be conservation across the bilaterium, which is Hox gene expression. So, and you've probably all seen this Scientific American picture that shows the Hox complex of Drosophila and the organization of the Hox genes from 3' to 5' end of the chromosome, paralleling the organization of the body domains in which those genes are expressed. And the same in the mouse, where, at least in the central nervous system, you can make a similar argument. There are four Hox clusters instead of one. Many other gene sets have also fourfold present in vertebrates instead of one. And so because of this amazing retention, conservation across the whole bilaterian tree, a good argument, a reasonable argument, is that the bilaterian ancestor had a Hox complex in which this gene was expressed at the anterior end, although it's not really the anterior end of the body. In no organism is it really expressed at the anterior end, but in us it's expressed at the, up to the hind brain and not the anterior part, and in flies not quite at the anterior part either. And then other genes that are expressed in more posterior locations. And we know that yeah, very good question. There are several arguments as to why this is, and they fall into two classes, basically, those, the mechanistic arguments. You should ask Steve what he thinks about this also. So the two classes are that the order of expression parallels a vectorial growth process where it starts here and goes in this direction, and that the complex is wrapped in chromatin such that the genes become sequentially accessible to transcription factors, so that the earliest ones to become accessible are the ones that go on first and at one end of the structure, and then the next one, perhaps because of the activation of the first one. That's one general class of arguments. The second class of arguments is entirely different than that. And it is that the cis-regulatory modules that control Hox gene expression are spread out and interchanged along this system so that the regulator for this gene may be in between the next two genes, the regulator for the next gene may be downstream or upstream of the next gene, so that if that organization is ever broken, then a gene will be isolated from its regulator and will be held to pay, and so it's prevented from losing this organization because of that. And there are also is a third variant of that, which is that part of the regulation of the Haas complex operates like in the globin complex with a distant locus activating element that's at one end of the complex, and it affects the successive genes, these are the posterior ones, so that the one closest to it is affected more strongly than the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. You could think of many reasons why that would be. However, Hox genes have nothing to do with segmentation. They have to do with the process of metamerization does not depend on Hox genes in any animal. They're not the same segment. The segments are not homologous, really. I also should say that this is a very nice picture, but in many animals don't have a Hox complex, and they're perfectly good animals. Sciona doesn't have a Hox complex. Its Hox genes are blown all over the genome. Neither does the nematode C. elegans have a real Hox complex. There are a couple of... They've broken in half. And also, the posterior genes are very non-homologous. And we have about five of these things for this one, and they vary a great deal among animals, among the deuterostomes. So many animals don't even have a Hox complex. So we have to be a little bit careful about this. Yes? I can't answer to you why the... I mean, don't push me on why the complex has retained, because I don't work on them myself, and there, I just told you the going arguments out there. None of them are completely satisfactory.
Right. So, whatever that wanted to ask about, why we have a sort of an understanding of how the segments are set up.
Right.
And then each of the segments, one of the important components of that. Do we have any understanding of how that works in mouse? Because you have a...
Yeah. Sure. But we don't have really a similar linear organization. We have... It's not, we don't have anything like, for example, T2 and T3 and Drosophila as being the domain and A1 of being the domain of UBX function, or T3 and A1 and Drosophila. There's nothing like that in animals to speak of. And there are, for example, all of the anterior Hox genes collaborate in a little network organization in setting up the rhombomeres in the hindbrain. And there's seven rhombomeres in order, and it is true that HOX1A or HOX A1 and B1 go on in the anterior ones relative to HOX4 and 5 in the posterior ones, but then they cross-regulate one another, and there's a number of out-of-register examples. And unfortunately, as soon as you look under this rug, you see amazing differences and changes. And so it may be that that focusing on the homologies is blinding one to what's really going on. And the other thing that we know is that Hox genes, which have been studied, have the same kinds of complex six cis regulatory modules controlling as every other gene, and each module controls one aspect of each Hox gene's expression, just like every other gene. No. There's something a little bit similar in the group of genes that controls mesoderm function, an NK class of homeodomain genes. There is the parahox locus, where there are three genes that have that may be related to the Hox locus evolutionarily, which have somewhat different anterior posterior addresses in the gut, but that's again frequently obscured by alterations in that. And there are, however, a number of gene families which are clustered, and in which the order of expression is is dependent on the order in the genome, and the best known of them is the hemoglobin gene family, where there are a number of genes in us that are set out along that thing, and some of them, and the ones at one end go off first, and the next ones go off next, and that also means that they're expressed in different hematopoietic cell types. So linear chromosomal order that affects gene expression is not unknown elsewhere. Boris. There are no other genes interspersed inside of these, that's correct. There are flanking genes on both ends outside of them, even skipped as one, and some collagen genes on the other end that are also, by the way, a conserved feature across the bilaterium. Well, as you can see, there have been genes lost from, for instance, this gene has been lost from these two clusters, and this gene has been lost from this cluster, so they're not entirely redundant. Well, every place that's been carefully, very carefully studied, which is not easy to do because it means knocking out the gene and then combining the knockouts and then combining the knockouts with the knockouts. Every place has been carefully studied, it's been shown that there are no entire redundancies, and the phenotype of knocking out all four of the genes is catastrophic, whereas the phenotype of knocking out one can often be minor. No, absolutely not. And I should also note that fish, for example, which are not that different from us, many fish have seven Hox clusters instead of four, and some may have even more than that. And many animals, like Amphioxus, have one, and so do sea urchins have one, which also, by the way, has a break in it, just like this, and an inversion, but a different break in a different place. No. I'm going to talk about what I think they are later on, if I get there. I have an idea what they are that's different from... I mean, they do a lot of things. Some of them just run downstream differentiation genes occasionally. There's a Hox gene in our immune systems that's necessary for just making a differentiated immune cell. And they've acquired all kinds of functions. A lot of them run cell surface specific genes that make cell surface proteins that affect cell adhesivity, and they do a variety of grunge level downstream gene regulation, as well as some other things that are more interesting. But so I want to table that just for a little bit. I'm going to get to it though. I mean, I think so. Here is an example of how little the expressions of Hox genes have been conserved. If you actually start looking under the, if you pick up the rug and look under the rug, here are the bugs you see. Bad pun. Anyway, so this is in fact a centipede. A and B are a centipede, and it's stained with two immunological stains. One is stain that stains every appendage in green. And centipedes, as you know, have appendages on every segment from head to tail. And the head ones come out first. And the other is a stain that identifies the products of two Hox genes together. And so in the centipede, you can see that these are UBX and antennapedia. So these domains of expression aren't that different from what you'd see in an insect. So the northern part of the abdomen and pieces of the thorax, thoracic region, and after the after a little while, you can see that every place that has an appendage beyond the head, from the second thoracic segment, which is the same place that UBX, the anterior domain of UBX expression is in insects, every place on down, both the appendage marker and the Hox gene are expressed, and so you get green. You get green plus red gives you a yellow. Well, here is an onychophorin, and I mentioned to you before that was a lobopodial a descendant of the lobopodial arthropods, the kind of Cambrian arthropod that was dominant then, which had no joint, had appendages but no jointed appendages. It's the velvet worm, and it's sort of the outgroup to all the arthropods. It's the sister group of the arthropods. Well, here it has appendages all the way up and down, all right, but those two genes are expressed only in the last segment. So it ain't like you need Antennapedia and UBX to make thoracic and abdominal segments. That's the insects and the arthropods use them for something in that. But this animal has those same segments. It has appendages. But you don't need it to make appendages, do you? You need it. So they're both expressed only in the last segment in that animal. So that's just an interesting example of the fact that don't jump to conclusions from looking at this picture. And you should consider, in fact, that the most important thing about the Hox genes is how often their use has been co-opted to everything in the world. And because they're useful. And here are the classes of arthropods, the insects, crustaceans, centipedes, spiders, and the outgroup Onychophorans. And this just shows you on the common body plan of those animals, which is arthropod phyletic character, they all have. So they all have these head segments, which produce different chewing organs. They also have the thoracic segments, which are indicated by T, and so forth. And the corresponding homologous segments are lined up on this diagram. But you can see that given Hox gene is expressed up to different levels in this segmental, homologous segmental body plan in these different classes. So they're co-opted to different functions, and it is not the case that people assume when they were looking at this, oh, Hox 4 means make segment X. It's just absolutely wrong. No, go ahead. Okay, Boris, you first, huh? Well, that's a very interesting, excellent question. So in my view, what is conserved is only one thing, which is that this is an abstract argument, but I think it's a correct argument. This is a vectorial patterning system. And it can be used for patterning any piece of the organism where it's desired to have one end differentiated in terms of regulatory state from the other end, and to have intermediate positions specified by arranging a nested set of A plus B plus C plus D, A plus B plus C, A plus B, A. And so it's a system that's set up to do that. It's been used for a number of pieces of the body in that way. For example, in us, it's used to pattern our limbs in a direction orthogonal to the body axis. It's also used to pattern our genitalia, again in a direction orthogonal to the body axis. And so the only thing that's really conserved is the use of the, that's one thing that's conserved, is the use of the cluster to give related positional information. So I call it a vectorial patterning system. Yes, they do that very often. They set up networks so that they prevent one another from being expressed. Now they have another feature, another major feature, which I'm going to get to if I get there, of how they work. Yes. Well, it's a little different in Drosophila and mice, so that in Drosophila, there are places in the organism where given Hox gene or two are expressed. In mice, you tend to have rather a nested, and in most organisms, rather a nested sets of expression. So, for example, I should ask him, he's an expert on this, but in the limb bud at the posterior end, all of the posterior Hox genes are expressed, and as you move towards the more anterior positions, instead of getting all of them, you get all minus one, then all minus two, then all minus three, and then just one at the anterior thing. So you have these nested expression sets, which is maybe combinatorial for maybe that all of them are being used in the posterior side in the limb bud. But so this kind of one position, one gene situation is uncommon in invertebrates. And even in flies, the abdominal ones are like that. So, of course, I could talk all day about that, too. I'm here for one talk on this subject, so we got a lot of ground to go over. So, co-option, how does it happen? mostly people just look at patterns. There's a whole world. There's a huge industry which has been given a kind of a comic book slang name, which it deserves, called Evo Devo, of looking at patterns of expression of things, just looking at it and logging the differences. But it's very hard to put your finger on actual sequence level cases that explain co-option or use of a gene in a different place at a different time. I'm going to show you one though. So we can infer that these are the things that could cause a co-optive change in regulatory gene expression. These things are right. So you could either change a cis regulatory module that's running a given gene or put a new module into the gene. That could happen by transposition of a module from somewhere else. So anything can happen, but some kind of change in the regulatory, cis regulatory modules has to take place. So I'm going to give you now a case where you can really see what happened, or at least see something anyway. I mean, I wasn't there, so I can't tell you what happened, but you can see at the sequence level a difference. So here's the phylogeny. I think I showed you in my last talk of echinoderms. So these are the five echinoderm classes. The starfish, brittle stars, sea urchins, sea cucumbers, and crinoids. And as I mentioned, we know that the starfish and sea urchins had a last common ancestor. This guy, from the fossil record, lived right at the end of the Cambrian, around 500 million years ago. So half a billion years ago, these guys began to diverge in separate directions. Or almost that length of time. And I'm going to talk to you about a difference in the use of an important regulatory gene in these guys as opposed to these guys. If you look at the fate maps of the embryo, the legend says they're similar, but they're also different. So they're similar in terms of the endoderm and the mesoderm, where the endoderm develops around the mesoderm. If you look at the egg from the bottom in both animals, this is a starfish, this is a sea urchin. But they differ in that the sea urchins have a larval embryonic skeleton, which I showed you the other day. This is the same picture you saw the other day. And the starfish just doesn't have that. The sea urchins also have pigment cells. The starfish don't have that either. So one of the genes that I mentioned to you the other day in the skeletogenic pathway was T-brain. And T-brain is used in the skeletogenic cells to make a skeleton, but in the starfish, T-brain is used in the endoderm to make a gut and a mesoderm. And if you, so here's its expression in the starfish embryo, and if you stop its expression, you get an embryo with no gut, as you can plainly see. This is a normal embryo. This is mesoderm, this is endoderm. You don't get either if you block T-brain expression. If you do the same experiment, a sea urchin, this is the experiment. You get, just look at these two guys. You look at, you get the opposite effect. You get an embryo with perfectly nice gut, but it doesn't have a skeleton. This is a control embryo. That's the same gene. It's an orthologous gene, exactly almost the same DNA binding sequence. And the gene is expressed in a different place. It's expressed in skeletogenic cells in sea urchin, expressed in the endomesoderm in the starfish. So that's a classic case of co-option. And it ain't there for nothing, because as you just saw, if you interrupt the function of the gene, there are different catastrophic results. Say what? No. The plesiomorphic state is to have an adult skeleton, but not a larval. And this is a sea urchin invention. And I'm gonna, if I get time to, I'm gonna tell you probably what happened, because we figured that out just recently to cause that to happen. So here it is in the. You saw this subnetwork in discussing the sea urchin gene network the other day. And remember, this is this double negative PMAR1 onto this thing which we now know as HESC, which regulates a number of downstream genes. And so repressing this repressor in the micromeres allows all these genes to run in the micromeres. And here's T-brain, one of them. If you make a T-brain cis-regulatory construct running a fluorescent protein reporter injected into the egg, it gives you beautiful results, and you can see just the skeletogenic cells lined up along the skeleton expressing that reporter. So the T-brain regulatory system is very skeletogenic specific. It doesn't run anywhere else, as you can plainly see in this diagram. This is in contrast to where it runs in the starfish or sea star. Co-option. And a specific difference in a function as displayed by, in the course, yeah.
You take the starfish,
I'll just show you what happens. So a specific difference in T-brain function, which was revealed in trying to find out what were all the genes affected when T-brain was shut off, is that in sea urchins, T-brain has no effect on OTX, which we discussed. Remember, it was a key player in that little kernel of five regulatory genes. But in sea stars, amazingly, you shut T-brain off, you shut OTX off. And OTX, and I showed you that little kernel, is necessary in sea stars to make the endoderm, just like it is in sea urchins. And so here's a completely different input into an essential and conserved element. That's interesting to me. So now Veronica Hinman isolated the starfish T-brain cis-regulatory module, and we already had known from Kathy Yu's work about the sea urchin one. And I can't explain the following to you. I can explain to you why it has the same sites, the GATA, Crox, and OTX sites, because those are the inputs from that other feedback, 5-gene feedback system that I know are there. But why it has the same number of these sites, I really can't tell you. So there are 5 GATA sites in both of these things. There are 3 OTX sites in both of these things. And there's 2 Crox sites. But you'll notice that the positions of them are quite different, except for one thing. There is a cluster of OTX and GATA sites in both of them, and those turn out to be the most important of either species. Okay. But there's a T-brain site. There's actually 2 T-brain sites in the starfish cis-regulatory module, and those are not there in the sea urchin one. So, are we going to find a smoking gun here? We can be able to see, well, the difference really is that this cis-regulatory module has T-brain sites and the other one doesn't. And that's what makes a difference in their expression. So we decided to try to find out. So here's an experiment that shows that a starfish expression construct with a reporter added to it, which is symbolized in green here. If you look at its expression in an embryo in which T-brain is not permitted to be expressed, it knocks it down almost completely. And if you mutate the target sites for T-brain, which is this one here compared to normal expression, you knock it down. And so also are all the other sites important that you saw. These are the Croc sites, these are the OTX sites, these are the goddess sites, or some of the goddess sites. So these are basically all the sites, the different kinds of sites that you saw here, they're all necessary for expression. And that's true in the sea urchin one too, except for T-brain's not a player in the sea urchin. So then you can ask the question that somebody just asked. What happens if I take the T-brain, this starfish piece of the cis regulatory module that contains the T-brain sites, and put it in the sea urchin one? So what happens is that if you put the starfish, if you put the sea urchin T-brain cis regulatory module into a starfish, it's completely dead. It won't run. Well, you say, oh, I guess it won't run because it needs T-brain. If you're in a starfish, it must not have enough of something else or whatever. But what about the reverse? And logic says the reverse should work, and it does work. So if you put the starfish T-brain site in the sea urchin, it runs fine. Sea urchin. So now what happens if you take the starfish piece of DNA and either put this whole insert or mutate the T-brain sites in the insert, this is a neat experiment, and put that into the sea urchin one, and now put that into the starfish. And so the results shown here, this is the sea urchin one with this insert, and if you mutate those sites, you lose most of the activity. And if you don't put it in at all, you lose even more activity. Why this isn't quite as low as this, I don't know. But anyway, the experiment is clear, and it shows that the there's a slight difference in the organization of these sites in here. But it shows that the T-brain site is indeed what's responsible for this difference in downstream function of T-brain. And T-brain is useful in the endomesoderm because it can interact with these sites. So this is a case of catching co-option in the act, so to speak. But you won't find many cases like this in the literature. Yeah. Pardon? And the spatial patterns are okay. But you won't find many cases like this in the literature. It's surprising. We all know that this has to be true, but there are just very few cases where you can put your finger on the ACG and P's responsible for it that are demonstrated functionally, as in the case I just gave you. So now, of course, I have to, if we really want to know what's happening, we have to look at this at the level of what can make a difference, which is gene networks. It's the gene network subcircuits that do the jobs of development, as I tried to tell you last time I was here. So we mentioned gene regulatory network kernels, and I gave you the example of this sea urchin starfish endomesodermal specification kernel, and pointed out that what's in common is an amazing amount of feedback circuitry and other wiring. And so we can have the idea that kernels have certain properties, that they're highly conserved. They each do a certain job. They're not like something like feed-forward circuit, which is used for 1,000 different things. They're a specific organization of specific genes used for a specific developmental purpose. In this case, for example, there's nowhere else in the sea urchin embryo that those five genes are hooked up together or used for that purpose. A few of them are used for other things. And we have to understand why this has been conserved for 500 million years. And the reason is, as I said the other day, that if I kill GATA E, then I'm going to kill OTX. If I kill OTX, I kill the rest of it. It's lethal. If I kill OTX, the same thing is true. And these have downstream functions, but they all have multiple inputs from OTX and from GA to E. And so it's resistant to change because, and there's also a feedback relation between LIMP1 and Crocs and OTX throughout. And so it's highly resistant to change because of the fact is that the way it's wired up with the same, with individual genes having multiple inputs throughout the subcircuit, that it's hard to do anything to any piece of it without wrecking the whole thing. Not at all. They're all over the place. Yeah, and we know that from the genome sequence. These are trans regulatory relationships encoded in the cis regulatory DNA of those genes. So there's an idea. There should be such kernels. So now you might say, well, are there any other ones out there? Looking in the literature, this is a little exercise I did, which was easy for Drosophila, because Drosophila molecular biology is so clear compared to anything else. It's a pleasure to deal with, but wading through the vertebrate heart gene regulatory literature is not so easy. But anyway, my heart experts tell me that it's not wrong. So this is a gene regulatory network you can stitch together from 100 individual pieces of data published in the vertebrate literature. And this is a Drosophila gene regulatory network that comes to some extent from the work of Manfred Frosch and Bodmer, but from a few other people as well. And it refers to the early part of heart specification in the two organisms. If you actually look at this, you see that there are many, many things that are basically in common once you realize that the genes that are color-coded the same are the orthologous genes. They're also wired the same to a large extent. I'll just give you one example. For example, Tin Man in Drosophila, which is NKX2.5 in the vertebrate, activates a GATA gene, which is called Panier in Drosophila, and a GATA4 in the vertebrate. And then there's a feedback that ends up back on Tin Man, or NKX2.5, in both systems. And there are several such things that are quite similar in these, and you can see a basically similar architecture. Now we're talking about something that goes back to the origin of the Bilateria, because there's nothing in common since the last common ancestor of the Bilateria between Drosophila and vertebrates. Yes. It specifies a cardiac field. It specifies a progenitor field for the heart, and its subdivision into different cell types occurs downstream of this. It also runs via some of these other genes like MEF2, which is present in both of these systems. Again, in both systems, MEF2 has inputs. This is what's in common from both Tin Man and the GATA gene. And they run directly contractile cells. Yes. So where Tin Man goes on in both cases defines a progenitor field, and where Tin Man and the T-box proteins go on define a progenitor field. Upstream of it is different completely in the two organisms. So the only thing that's similar is that both of them receive a TGF-beta input into the Tin Man cis regulatory module in both of them. But the upstream way that the body axes are set up is quite different. Upstream what? It's different in the two cases. This is just what goes on in the progenitor field from the heart. And the way that that's set into the body axis is different in the two cases. So that's why we can talk about subcircuits with different evolutionary history than the rest of the apparatus. Well, it's not so simple, of course, to get the ectopic expression of a network that includes these T-box genes plus this gene plus this T-box gene plus that gene. Like, there are probably four minimum genes that would have to be done. This is exactly what you would have to do in order to, and the experiment has actually been done in Drosophila of overexpressing these genes. And if you overexpress within an allowable domain, if you overexpress using a promoter that runs in a larger area, if you overexpress one of them, you get very little increase in heart. If you overexpress all three or four, then you get excess heart tissue. So what you would predict is exactly the case, in that it's never been done anything close to it in vertebrates. But in general, to re-engineer any of these developmental systems, what is needed, the rational approach is going to be to take the essential piece of the network and take it, not some particular gene. So right now in our lab, we're trying to make this thing go in an ectopic position, see if we can get a second gut out of it, for instance. Yes. Yes. Both things I would say would be true. There's no other, no redundant, this is not redundant with anything, and it is irreducible. You get no end of mesoderm, in fact. And that's true, by the way, for all the genes in the heart kernel I showed you, and for this. You get no heart there, you get no end of mesoderm there. I would say the opposite. The fact that you're looking at something that survived half a billion years of evolution is the definition of robustness. Well, it's not a mathematician. It's not a definition in terms of circuit noise, which I think is just irrelevant for these kinds of systems. But it's a definition in real life of what is really robust. Robust in the English dictionary means that it's not easily subject to failure, and that's exactly, this is built not to fail. That's for sure. Yeah, well, you also can easily fail by cutting your head off. I mean, it doesn't mean you're not robust, but all I want to say is all the wiring surrounding this is, most of it's changed between sea urchins and starfish. This thing just stands out like a rock in the sand in terms of evolutionary flexibility. Yes, or the quality of how flexible it is. This is inflexible, and that which surrounds it is flexible. And I would claim that these similar wirings is the same thing across a much, much, much more extensive domain. Of course, but in the case of that, as I show, Of course I understand. But that's why it's so important that the gene network that I showed you the other day is nearing a state of completeness and for that embryo, for that part of the embryo. So we know mostly everything that's there. And so I don't, so I can now ask the question, is this the same or is it not the same, without worrying about other things out in the bushes that might be there and be the same or not the same. So I can answer the question. In this particular case, the surrounding networks around the heart are not known. So I don't, on the other hand, the possibility that anything is the same between Drosophila and a vertebrate at the level of all this detailed wiring is astounding. And in the case of this, we know a lot more because we can have looked at the surrounding linkages. And for instance, in the mesoderm that this thing is hooked up to, everything is different. Everything is different in the starfish, but this piece is not different. I think there's very little bistable switches in this because there's never any choice between which one of the partners does what. Everything is made to go in one particular direction. So it's not bistable. It's stable, all right. One of the characteristics of the wiring, which I haven't had time to discuss, is that it's tremendously, it's overlain in the sense that if there's something that makes a particular set of genes go on, there'll be something else entirely independent that prevents it from going on elsewhere. And there'll be a number of independent devices, all of which militate towards the same end result. And so these things are, as I like to say, they're built to run and not to fail. And that's not only a characteristic of the internal wiring of a circuit like this, which is certainly a stabilization circuit, because once these genes are locked in and embraced, they... Yes, correct. It's a forward drive program with lots of crosstalk, with independently running independent circuits that make it do what it's going to do. For instance, every time one, for instance, this gene here, downstream, it's a repressor. It represses itself, so it oscillates. But downstream of this are other genes that repress this. What are those genes? So early in development, the specifications say it represses the possibility that these cells could go in another direction altogether, which are mesoderm. Now, normally, they're never going to do that anyhow. It's kind of a fail-safe device, and they might do it because mesoderm specification depends on notch signaling, and there is a stage when these cells are exposed to notch, and it doesn't want these cells to listen to that at all. But that's just an example of an additional device besides telling it to be gun and telling it not to be anything else. Did you say, are they?
Yes.
Most of these genes are expressed elsewhere. GATA E is expressed all over the place in different types of cells. Not everywhere. There's another GATA gene that's expressed only in immune cells of the serogen. It's its wiring. Yeah. It's called a DNA sequence. It's the sequence of their cis regulatory module. Say that again. Yes. Yes. Well, remember, in this case, the one that goes on first in the endomesoderm is this guy, and in time, this kicks it off. And there's also an early form of OTX that's present. And so those guys started off in the right place, and the this gene is forbidden to be expressed anywhere but in the right place. But this is a transient state, and it listens only to inputs that are quite early. And in fact, as I described to you last week, this is that gene that describes this expanding torus of gene expression. So its expression is transient, but once it gets this other gene involved, and then this gene turns on that gene because of the wiring, because of the sequence of the cis regulatory module of this gene, which has target sites for OTX in it, as we know. Once that happens, and then that feeds back on this, which has target sites for GATA in it, then those guys don't need this input anymore. And it can go away, and it does go away for reasons that we understand. So once that happens, then all these genes are locked into a permanent state of expression in this area, in this domain of the embryo.
This is exactly a feedback loop which is quite stable. It receives a signal that it switches to a state where they maintain even that.
Well, bistable is often used to mean it can go either this way or that way, but in this case, it only goes that way. That's my objection to the term. And then none of these genes go on, and they do not. So, in true bistable conditions, for example, there might be a reciprocal repressor, where when one state goes on, it represses the other. And when that state goes on, it represses the one. And that's a true bistable kind of a state. This does not have any function outside of this domain whatsoever. Yes. They are individually used in, well, brachyury, they're individually used at different stages in the life cycle. Every transcription factor has many modules and many lines. So, because every one of these guys has multiple inputs, and OTX alone is not enough to turn on GATA E. No, well, it has additional inputs, and those inputs are only present here, yes. And all the inputs are not shown in all of these cis regulatory modules. Only the relations amongst them, which are in common between these things, are shown in this particular diagram. We would have to go back to the network to see what all the inputs are. But first place, if you express BLIMP1, there are several reasons. First of all, GATA E will not run only on an OTX input. And so you're dead there. You have to give GATA E another input. And there's another input that's not shown here that it needs. It has an input via notch signaling, and it also has a repression, a TCF repression system in it. And so there are a number, every one of these things has multiple inputs, let's put it that way.
Okay, I guess the thing I was thinking about before you said you would have to express a few different genes to make
the kernel run. Yeah, I made an offhand rash comment about what you might have to do, which I can't tell you whether it would work because we're just trying it now. But well, I'll be able to tell you the answer to that next year. My suspicion is that if you can force the expression of OTX and GATA E together, that will be sufficient. But I could be wrong. But what? That's true. There's probably lots of things. Now, it's true, but there are many, many genes. So this is a downstream of this kernel are lots of other genes, more than what's shown here. And I could take all those other genes and make them all run on some, but then I'd have to deal with eight genes, and then instead of dealing with one, well, I might be able to do it just by dealing with two genes. That's all. Yes, exactly right. That's right. So what I want to say, so these are all, this is all ideas except for one irreducible amazing fact, which is seeing this evolutionary conservation of this much wiring over in 500 million years. And I think that if you look in my 2006 book, there are a number of other cases in brain patterning and a few and gut patterning where there probably are kernels sitting out there waiting to be discovered, and just from what are waiting to be actually just analyzed from what's already in the literature. And one of the most interesting things to do in evolution, after all, we'd like to know what comes from where and how old different features are, is start thinking about what does it mean that we have had the same basic phyletic body plans since the Cambrian. And so last winter, Doug Irwin is a paleontologist that I collaborate with, made a proposition that which of course I tipped my hand deliberately in this talk, that there will be, that the basic phyletic body plans will be underlain by kernels for those parts of the organism that define the phyla that have been with us since the Cambrian, and that will, which will be conserved subnetworks where we'll be able to see similar linkages, that superclades like the deuterostomes, which is more than one phylum, have certain things in common, and each phylum will have certain things in common. And so this argument predicts the existence of regulatory subcircuits of the network that are required for the initial specification of a given type of body part in a given place of the organism, not its elegant details of how it develops downstream of the initial specification, but says you are going to have a heart, and you are going to have it in your dorsal mesoderm. You are going to have a brain, and it's going to be here, and it is going to have medial, lateral, and lateral columns of neurons, and so forth. And you are going to have a gut, and it's going to be defined by a certain group of genes that are going to set up the field the gut forms from, and that those basic aspects of the body plan, the prediction is a testable prediction, no idea is worth salt if it isn't testable, that there will be gene network subcircuits that will in fact make sense out of the amazing fact that that the phyla have been, their body plans have been stable ever since the Cambrian. Functionally sufficient to define the progenitor field for the body part. Yes, other. I didn't say that. I said a good answer to that question is if those five genes go on, I will tell you will have a gut. If those five genes can be made to run with the interrelationships that which they already have, then you will have a gut. That's what I'm saying. So it's a, I mean, why not make a strong form of an argument that can be shot down? Fine.
The network that you showed us. Mm-hmm.
job in life is to set up the conditions for not only brachyury and FOXA, but several other genes as well that are required to cause endoderm. They each do a different thing. That's right. This is an echinoderm kernel. I mean, I'm sure it'll be in hemichordates too. But so I think most of the kernels we see are going to be phyletic, and there will be a few things that are going to be transbilaterian. But we make hearts differently than we make guts differently than they do. But we make hearts all across the bilateria. There's something similar about the heart specification. So Linnaean classification is a hierarchically nested set of characteristics, but so are the retention of features. Yes, that's what I'm saying. Now this is transbilaterian. And there are going to be some things that are going to be transbilaterian. The fact that you can even see sets of connections and particular feedback circuits using particular genes in the same genes from Drosophila to us is an amazing thing that has to be thought about. Well, here, you mean a transbilaterian? There are, look at my book, there are a few that you could point to. I think a few, yeah, less. But they're all sitting there waiting to be discovered. Yeah. Yeah. So, now here's a further elaboration of the other side of the coin, which is that most pieces of gene regulatory networks are not conserved or change much more rapidly. And so if you look at a gene regulatory network, you discover it has a modular character, as I said at the outset. It's made of subcircuits. Those different kinds of subcircuits evolve very differently. And they account for a lot of evolution, which is subphyletic, the kinds of things that's happened since the Cambrian, perhaps. So I'm just giving you an idea here. But I'd rather give you an idea than just wave my hands and say evolution happened. So we like to define a series of different kinds of gene regulatory network components. Kernels, we talked about, the things we call plug-ins, just because they seem to be plugged in all over the place in the network and looking at different organisms, and where they're plugged in changes very rapidly, and this is one of the main flexible aspects. And a typical example of a plug-in is signal systems. For example, notch-dependent signal systems, or wind-dependent signal systems. Those things are plugged into every gene regulatory network you look at, always in a different place, and they change even, they're different even between species of given genera, and they're different amongst genera of given families. Yet they do something, and they transduce signals and turn them into regulatory states. So they're very useful, but they change a lot. They're the opposite of kernels in terms of their flexibility. What? The switches that lead to exactly are flexible. What do you mean it doesn't do anything? I'm going to discuss eyes. Funny you mentioned that, if I have time or if you want me to do so. But we have to distinguish between differentiation gene batteries, which are probably much older than any of these morphogenetic pathways. which make particular cell types, because the most simple organisms like sponges have differentiated gene batteries. We have to distinguish between that and the morphogenetic pathways that build the body parts of animals. Some of them are much older than complex animals. I think visual gene batteries that run opsins and gene batteries that run that make muscles or contractile cells and so forth are certainly older than the Bilateria. But these morphogenetic subcircuits are not older than the Bilateria. They define the Bilateria. And another concept I'd like to think about is input-output switches. So there are subcircuits that do things like make hearts, and then there are switches on the outside of them that say you can run or you cannot run in this place. And we can find them because we destroy the switches, then we get heart running in a different place. And one of the main things that Hox genes do is they play this role, and they play it very flexibly. So this is our idea that different kinds of changes of different aspects of gene regulatory networks result in different kinds of evolutionary consequences, which affect different levels of taxonomy, basically. That many of the differences in speciation are differences in differentiation gene battery, like what kinds of keratin you make in your skin, which is a typical species different, or what kind of fur or feathers you have, which depends on the mobilization and constitution of differentiation gene batteries. But you can't get a different body part, like a wing instead of a leg, that way. The same differentiation gene batteries are used more or less to make very different body parts. And so the upper scale changes in morphology, which is what you see in the fossil record as differences among animals since the Cambrian, are what we would call class or order or family characters in a Linnaean sense. And I agree with you, we don't want to really pay too much attention between the boundaries between them, but they're somewhere between the phylum or the class and the species. And these involve changes in size, like how big it's going to be, and they're often mediated by moving signal systems around so that some subcircuit which makes some structure is either activated or not activated in a different place. This is in that Science 2006 paper, if you want to. It's just an idea. Sure. Please.
At some point, the animals become the phyla and the common ancestor.
Yeah.
And so, would you say, well, back then, birds were evolving, and then the guardians and all the species were developing, were evolving, and then now the alternatives? How do you get away from that picture?
That's the right picture. That since the Cambrian, we've had tremendous changes in deployment of switches on different regulatory programs and deployment of signaling systems, what I call generally plugins, and there's some other ones, and that kernels evolved before the Cambrian or in connection with the advent of the different phyletic body plans that exist. That's a specific proposition. Yes, those are there before. Those are there before. We find muscle gene batteries in cnidarians, but they don't share most aspects of our body plans, for example. We find neurons, and that's a differentiated cell type in cnidarians. We find gland cells in cnidarians. We find all kinds of, not all differentiated gene batteries, of course, but some.
Thank you.
It is the case there have been no new phyletic body plans since the Cambrian. That's not a theory, that's a fact. Well, draw your own conclusion. It has to mean, in terms of gene regulatory networks, that the level that evolution of the parts of the network that control certain levels of the process haven't changed since then. That they have not evolved further. So the decision as to whether we're going to have a gut has been made and ain't going to be made again. I don't know about never, but I mean, since the Cambrian, it has not been revisited. And partly for the good Darwinian reason that the gut works, and if you have a two-ended gut, you're going to eat anything that doesn't, because you work better. I mean, there have been canalizations that have, things that, once things work, they stay. Also, they change the environment themselves. That's exactly true. But the fact is, you can decide why it is any way you want, but the fact is, there have been no changes in phyletic body plans since the Cambrian, and if you want to say that that the basic aspects of the body plan we know are controlled by regulatory circuits, and if it is true that very conserved regulatory circuits can be related to major features of the body plan, then we have to face the fact that if I'm right, then the kernels were there by the Cambrian, and the way that the various other things were deployed has changed, because they can change. But
Of course.
Because the traditional neo-Darwinian synthesis has argued that evolution has to be considered as a continuous process of small changes. Obviously, nothing, once you start thinking about evolution in terms of changes in gene regulatory networks, there are no small changes except at this level. At that level, it's all small changes. You change a few amino acids in a keratin, you change its properties, you add a few more keratins to the 52 that we have, you change the property of the keratin gene barrier. Those are small changes. Those things evolve continuously. Most of that kind of argument is extrapolated from speciation between where the differences are small, but I claim it has just zilch to do with developing the body plan. That's right. They do change rapidly, though, in many ways. Well, we've had neurons forever, and they use many of the same proteins in all animals, but they change. They change in deployment a great deal. It changes in its deployment. So differentiate, for example, think of all the places in your body that you have muscles. You have muscles in your eyelids. But other animals don't have eyelids. So somehow the same differentiation gene battery has been deployed in your eyelids as well as your nostrils and all the other things that other animals don't have. So there's a continuous change in deployment of differentiation gene batteries that occurs very rapidly, although the core of a muscle gene battery is really very old. And in addition, whether you have 15 fast twitch myosins or 10 or 3 is something that also changes rapidly, but you always have a fast twitch myosin if you are a vertebrate. Now if you're a sea urchin, you don't have any fast twitch myosins, but nonetheless you still have muscle gene barriers, still run by the same myo-D and and several other factors that always run muscle gene batteries. So gene batteries are never exactly the same in any two animals. They change, but yet you can always say there's a muscle gene battery. You can recognize it by its proteins and by its regulators. I don't think there have been, because we only have heads where we have them, and we only have guts where we have them, and so forth. We don't know enough to know whether there are phylum-level conserved kernels, which affect more detailed characteristics that are conserved equally long. Like, for example, maybe class level characteristics have also been conserved for those classes that have been around since the Cambrian. It's possible that they are. Remember, my friend, that we didn't even have a gene regulatory network until 4 years ago. So we're thinking now in the terms, or 5 years ago, we're thinking in the terms which may be necessary to explain evolution, but we have a very small information base so far.
I'm wondering to what extent these structures are sort of a reflection of the fact that both the evolution and the cell lineages in the development are essentially trees.
Essentially what? Trees.
So if you go back and say, you know, all Lutra cells, they're below some node in the evolutionary tree, and they're going to share, you know, part of their body plan, because it goes back to their ancestor, and what that body plan does is to basically specify another subnode in the tree of the cell lineage during development, and this is why you get these hierarchical structures that are conserved.
Most development of body parts has nothing to do with cell lineages, unfortunately. Whatsoever. None of Drosophila, not one piece of it, has anything to do with any cell lineage, and no part. And in a sea urchin embryo, where the lineage is defined, it's only defined for the first 6 or 8 cleavages. And it's a good way to get things started, but that's not true. But if every member of the species has a different lineage for the same body part, then the cell lineage has nothing to do with the process of development. And that's the case in frogs, for example. If you label a given blastomere in a frog, its descendants will be in a different place, a set of different places. They will never be the same twice, the same in a sea urchin, after the earliest stages, the same in a Drosophila. It is true. It's not true in C. elegans, but it's true in this. Everybody knows that there really isn't any the very earliest stages. In Xenopus, it's true. I know this literature very well. In Xenopus, it's certainly true that the blastomeres and the dorsal side have a higher probability of presenting their offspring there, but that's not really the question. It's an entirely different thing if I can get a perfectly good dorsal mesoderm or heart cell from an entirely different origin than if I can't. In the latter case, the lineage is a piece of a determinate mechanism. In the former, it's absolutely not. It's the ventral versus the dorsal part of an imaginal disc, which that's the only difference among them. And it's the same imaginal disc which separates, and there's absolutely no and what those cells do is imposed on them by the patterns of gene expression that they engage in.
Might be closer. If the
then the number of positions that are separated from another cell.
No, I wouldn't say so. They're both pieces of the epidermal. At the time that the nuclei move to the surface of the fly, then the nuclei that will appear in the imaginal disc are of the same ancestry as the nuclei they're going to invaginate and become the hindgut. I mean, they're a piece of the what was a syncytial system before that. Anyway, cell lineages are extremely useful mechanistically in two places. In later development, when given populations of cells are specified and their descendants do something. And in very early development, when in some but not all animals, vertebrates always excluded from this, there is a fixed relation between the cleavage planes and cell fate. And that's true in sea urchins, it's true in ascidians, but it only goes so far. Okay, let me go on. So, want to quit?